Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa.
Join us for half an hour of information,
entertainment,
reading recommendations,
and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
With me in the studio today is Lorraine Thompson. Kia ora, Lorraine.
Bonjour, Louisa.
Welcome to Books and Beyond. Now, Lorraine is a former magazine publisher and editor of a travel magazine and fitness magazine. She lives in Auckland and now is an independent director, an Archangel investor. Must find out more about that later on. And member of Global Woman, New Zealand's most influential women's leaders group. From the 1st of October this year, she joined the board of the Te Araroa Trail, New Zealand's trail, 33,000 kilometres from Cape Reinga to the Bluff in the south, which Karen and I spoke about briefly during our walking show a while back. And Lorraine is studying towards an MBA at the University of Auckland, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Wow. She has run 4 marathons, trekked across England, cycled around Taupo and also the Alps to Ocean events. Wow, Lorraine, that's what I want to say. This is an impressive list of achievements. I have to stop and take a breath after reading them all. I can't imagine the energy required to do all of that. So hopefully we'll have more time later on to talk about all these amazing achievements. But today you were here to talk about your new venture, which is your book, The French Way. It's just been released. And this is Lorraine's story of her solo journey from Saint-Pierre-de-Port in France, hence bonjour, I guess, over the Pyrenees and across the north of Spain to the ancient burial place of the Apostle St. James in Santiago de Compostela. So this is the El Camino de Santiago walking trail, which Karen and I have talked about previously in our shows. And I've just realised we've been very remiss, Lorraine, because we've never actually explained what it's about. We just go, oh, walking the Camino. And we know someone who walked a Camino. We talk about a book about the Camino, but we've never actually said what it's about. So I think you're the ideal person to explain to our listeners who are wondering what on earth we're going on about. Tell us all about the Camino de Santiago, please.
Right, where do I start? Goodness. It's an amazing adventure, I think you'd have to say. 800 kilometres is a huge distance to go, and so you really need to have the 40 days in order to do it. Yeah, it's mainly the people that you meet and the sites that you see. It's historical, it's cultural, it's religious, it's spiritual, and it's social, and it's all of those elements combined every single day that you're out there walking. Each corner you turn, you see a different sight or a different smell or different people that you meet. It's just an amazing experience.
Wow, yes. And it is a pilgrimage, isn't it? I mean, I remember reading once someone writing a comment, I can't remember where they voiced a disappointment that they didn't see enough nature. And I hadn't walked it at the time, but I remember thinking, but it's a pilgrimage. It's not a nature walk. It's not like walking the length of New Zealand and our beautiful Alps and things, isn't it? So it is a pilgrimage. So what does that mean to people, a pilgrimage, do you think?
Yes, so you're walking to the end point, which is Santiago de Compostela, where there is a cathedral, and that's where St. James was buried in AD 44, so a very long time ago. So the original pilgrims started walking there from the 11th century, and it's just carried on. And in more recent years, the numbers walking has actually escalated to 300,000 people walking it. So it's walking to the burial site of St. James.
Wow, yes, that's right. And I think further on after Santiago de Compostela is a further walk that people can do afterwards to Finisterre, but we can talk about that a bit later on. Now, with your book came this interesting stat. There has been a 1,000% increase in the number of pilgrims walking the Camino over the last 20 years. I don't know, are these your words? Stressed out people are fast turning to walking in the slow lane.
Yes, they are my words, and it's exactly what I came across. Stressed out people, yeah, fast walking, no, yeah, who had been living a fast life and choosing to walk in the slow lane.
Oh, that's the beautiful words and very, very clever. So is that why you decided to do Walk the Camino?
I was inspired by an amazing woman called Dorothy McMillan. She was in her 80s and she was the friend, a friend of ours, his mother. And I was just in awe that in her 80s she could walk this Camino, and she was telling me about it, and I always thought, oh my goodness, if you can do it, then I need to do this. And
wow,
so it had been on my bucket list for quite some time.
Ah, well, that was my next question, is when did you first hear about it? So thanks to Dorothy.
Mm.
So she did it on her own, did
yes.
she? In her 80s?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know if I would be so brave. I did meet another amazing New Zealander, Esther Patton, when I finished the Camino, the day after I finished it, and I was in a store and I could hear a Kiwi accent. And so, as we do, we start talking to each other. And so Esther was, I think at the time, 79, and she'd walked, she'd done the Portugal walk, and then she went on to write a book, Exciting 80s.
Mm.
And I chatted to Esther earlier in the year about her book. So that we have some amazingly strong women in our country, don't we?
Yes, we do. And some of the strong women I met don't necessarily want to tell you their age, I found, but there were strong men of the similar age walking as well.
Yeah, that's true. The Camino is full of people from not only all countries or corners of the world, but age and what do you think the split was, males and females on the walk?
Yes, I think it was pretty much half and half.
Yeah.
In addition, yeah, the age group as well was a factor. So there were a lot of people, I would say, aged between 20 and 30, approximately, and they were between university and their jobs or between relationships and taking time out. And then there were a lot of people aged between, I'd say, 60 and 70. So there were those two particular age groups I noticed.
Yeah, that's true. I did too. Yeah, the 90-year-olds, I did meet one 90-year-old, but also the younger graduates, I think. In Europe, I think there's still that difficulty finding employment after you graduate, and a lot of them are doing the walk with their friends. And I found them really interesting to meet and to talk to as well, yeah. So, having walked it myself and in two parts, each year apart, like you, actually we haven't talked about how you did that yet, but it seems a good time to bring up that there are so many people who also want to do this walk. Time does seem to be a barrier to preventing us from our busy lives to doing it. But I also think that doubt, can I really do that, is there in the back of people's minds. So what I've done today is, as well as talking about your book, gathered some questions from people who would like to walk the Camino one day or dream about it like we did. And I think you're the ideal person to help them, encourage them to perhaps do it, answer some of their questions. So one of the first questions I have, do you mind?
Yeah, sure.
Is from Annette. And Annette says, I am an experienced hiker who likes to walk in quieter places, i.e. the less travelled roads. Are there any parts of the Camino that are less frequented by, but lovely to visit, where you can still commune with nature and enjoy villages and historic places?
Yes, there are. And actually, if you're wanting to be on your own and not such a crowded environment, I would choose very carefully what time of the year that you walked. So last year I was walking in October, November, and it wasn't quite as popular time then. So I spent a lot of my time walking on my own in desolate parts. And yeah, so I think it's a matter of choosing what time of the year you go, because there are other parts of the year when that's very busy.
That's a good answer, yeah. And so it makes me think, and I'm wondering if Annette would Annette's next question was, so when you are walking on your own, how does that feel? I mean, from here in New Zealand, we're all going, oh, you know, I can just imagine my mother going, oh dear, is that safe? So did you feel safe walking alone on the trail?
Yes, I definitely felt very safe because there were, you know, even if there was no one in within sight, eventually there would be. There would always be someone behind you or in front of you. So never felt uncomfortable at all. It was very safe and you never heard of anything happening to anyone. In fact, it was the dead opposite. People would actually help you if you needed something. I definitely found people there wanting to help you the whole time.
Oh, yes, which reminds me, let's see if I can find it in your book. I found this, there's a part where you are helped by fellow pilgrims. I think there's a passing of gifts. Is there? Hang on, I should have prepared
myself. Yeah, I can probably guess what you're alluding to. So,
great.
Yeah, at one stage I was suffering very heavily from blistered feet,
and that's it, yes.
At the end of the day, I noticed most people were walking around in what I'd call a pair of jandals, but I didn't have any, and so I was walking up a cobblestone street at the end of one of the days, and I came across someone with a pair of jandals on, and I said, "Oh, look, where do you buy those? Because you know that's just what I need right now." And this lady, and she heard my sad story, which you might hear in a minute, and she took them off of her feet and gave them to me. And she said, look, you know, I have another pair, so you can have these. And I thought, oh, my goodness. And that was just one example of what happened on the Camino.
That's lovely, isn't it? Because where was she from?
She was actually from New Zealand, and that's, I was quite right, amazed because I hadn't actually at that stage met anyone from New Zealand. Yeah.
Isn't that lovely? I mean, and there was another one. Oh, I found it. I found the page. The ladies were from Kumeu in Auckland. Next, when talking with the Kumeu ladies, I mentioned I was writing a book and needed to buy a new pen. So she's already given you the jandals, right?
No, this was actually two other. So on one day, I met quite a few New Zealanders.
Oh, wow. Mm. As you do on the Camino. Okay, so these are the Kumeu ladies then. And one of these ladies put her hand in her bag and said, I could have her pen. So that was two gifts in one day, wasn't it?
I know. I felt like I think I mentioned in the book, felt like a charity case because people were giving me things and, you know, I was quite prepared to pay for it, but they just genuinely wanted to give me something.
Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. And that is the spirit of the Camino, isn't it?
It definitely is. Mm.
So actually, before we go on to the next question then, like I was saying earlier, I walked the Camino in two parts and you did too. But you've got a really far more interesting story behind your reasons why you walked it in two parts. It was like the most terrible start to a Camino anyone could ever have. So you arrive in Paris and your bags are missing. And I guess that had all your items ready for the Camino. So, I mean, how did you react? Well, I mean, what would you do? I wouldn't know what to do. I mean, I would have panicked. So what was that like to sort of travel halfway around the world and realise everything was missing?
Yes, it felt like the end of the world and I felt like crying. And, yeah, I just thought, oh, no, I've been planning for this for so long. And I packed my bag very carefully. And then, you know, my suitcase never arrived. The airline, which was Air France, had lost other people's bags too, and it was really very disappointing because my trip for the next 40 days had been planned, my accommodation was booked each night, and yet I had nothing to wear, no shoes, no walking poles, and so it was quite devastating, really.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, to have your shoes missing, you know, we're told to break in our shoes, to, you know, practice in them, and then they're missing. I mean, were you tempted to sort of pack up and go home then? I know you didn't because you went on to write part of the book, but were you tempted at all?
No, I wasn't tempted because I'm a very determined person. I just thought there must be a way around this, and so I thought, okay, well, I'll just have to buy new gear. And so I was 2 days in Paris, but there aren't exactly any sort of Kathmandu-type stores in Paris. So the next stop was Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, where the trek starts, and there was a outdoor store there, and I sort of went in the store and pretty much bought up the whole store, it felt like. the clothes weren't and shoes weren't exactly my sort of choice. And in fact, I felt a bit like a Boy Scout, and they were probably the most unsexy clothes ever. And that's what I had to wear.
Oh,
yeah,
that's true. We didn't get any photos in here, have
there
we?
Might be some of me wearing a very funny pair of shorts and a top and a hat that looked a bit like one of those Australian hats that was missing the corks hanging down.
Oh, right, yeah.
But the new shoes essentially wrecked my feet. So after 8 days of trekking, when I'd ended up in hospital on two occurrences, I had to return home. I could hardly walk.
Yeah. Oh. That's devastating. Mm-hmm. But I did meet people in similar situations where the doctors did advise them to stop walking, and some of them did rest a few days, but you chose to come home. And then what happened after that? What did you do in that year? You say it was a year between coming home and going back to finish it. So what happened in that year? Did you start on the book or...?
Yeah, so when I was doing the walk, I was pretty much writing down notes and downloading my photos and writing captions at the end of each day. So I had that sort of information already recorded for those 8 days that I had done. And over the next year, it was pretty much waiting for my feet to heal. So they were in a pretty bad state. And you do have to choose what month will be suitable for walking the Camino. And so this was last year. I headed off in October, which was 1 month later, and the weather was just much more suitable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. We must have just missed each other. We did September, and it rained a lot, actually. So you got the better weather, did you?
Yes.
Isn't that interesting? Closer to winter than European winter, but better weather. So so I was wondering, because we do these walks and we dream of writing a blog or writing a book, and so people like me dream it and don't do it. In fact, when preparing to chat with you today, I thought, oh, I'll just look up my diary to see what I wrote when I was in these places, you know, just a bit of fun. I didn't write anything. I must have gone out for dinner with people and didn't record it. And now, of course, I regret this. So when you're traveling and you know that you want to share this experience and these memories in a book, help me, Lorraine, what is the process? What should I have done?
Yes, so I was probably wearing my journalist hat along the way. And so whenever I came across people, I would ask them questions. I would say, you know, why are you doing this walk? And I was being very observant and writing down whenever I came to a stop anything that I'd seen and noticed. So that was a key element of it.
Ah, right, yes. Mm. And so did you, at the end of each day, did you sort of put your notes back together, or was it all after the walk?
Yes, so at the end of each day, and sometimes I'd finished walking by 2 or 3 in the afternoon, so that was time for me to just plonk myself down on a bed, hopefully, and write notes and download my photos and make sure I had the right captions for them.
That's the method then. Okay, I'll bear that in mind for next time. But I actually stayed in the albergues, so which makes it a bit more challenging, I think, in the bunk rooms with everyone else. So you did it differently, and I think that was a really good experience for me, reading your book and learning that other way of another way of walking the Camino, because it's, as we've said, the Camino is an personal experience. Everyone has their own way of wanting to do it and reasons for why doing it. So I was really interested in your way of doing it, having your own room and having the pre-booked rooms, which I never did. I was a bit naive, I guess, when I just took off. And how much planning goes into pre-booking everything? Because I think there would be people who would be interested in knowing that it may help them to sort of make those bookings.
Yes, it definitely made it so much easier and enjoyable. So the trick for me was to use a company that was experienced in the Camino, and so that company that I used was called Walker's World. They're on the North Shore and run by Jill Grant. So Jill planned my trip for me. She knew what level of fitness I was at, and she organised the accommodation for every night, so I didn't have to think, where am I going to stay tonight and try and find somewhere, and that made it really enjoyable.
Ah, yes. You don't have to worry about anything, and you don't have to carry the bag, which... does become a burden. It's part of the burden, I guess. I did book a taxi once that took my bag once with a friend, and it was so liberating. And of course, you always have to watch what you buy and things along the way. Who would you recommend your way of doing the Camino to? So who would it be ideal for? And would you do anything a little bit differently next time you do it?
Yes, so my bag was carted forward, and that meant that, you know, if I did actually want to buy something, I could put it in that bag and I actually didn't have to carry it forward.
Spanish shoes, perhaps?
I wanted to enjoy the Camino and not see it as a burden, and I could see so many people with heavy packs. They were really exhausted, and I often see them lying on the side of the road with their pack still on their back. It just looked really uncomfortable for me. Most people my age were doing what I was doing, which was having the bag carried forward to the next stage. It certainly made it really enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean, it's sensible for if we want to do it, that is the way to do to, you know, be able to do it. And certainly if I was to do the 800-kilometre trek again, it would be something that I would definitely look into, getting older myself. So I have another question from one of the people who would like to walk the Camino. So this is from Karen, and she's also another avid walker and trekker. I've always wanted to know more about what happens at day's end. E.g., do you have to book ahead? So we've already discussed that. It is an option for people. And do you sleep in bunk rooms? Well, you can. You can stay in albergues. Though from my experience, or from what I've heard also, with the popularity of the Camino, I think it's an option more people are not taking, because you want the surety of having somewhere to sleep at the end of the day. Are there lots of eating choices? Do you pretty much eat where you are? And who do you socialise with at night? That kind of thing. Very practical questions from
Karen. Yes, I was largely staying at kind of bed and breakfast type places, or otherwise in cities. Sometimes it was a hotel. You tended to just want to, for me, often I was so exhausted, I just wanted to collapse on the bed and not do anything and almost forget about eating. I was more interested in sleeping. That was the case quite often. Otherwise, along the way, there was what's called a pilgrim's meal. And if I'd finished trekking in the middle of the afternoon, that's when I felt like eating. So I think in the book I called it lana, which is a CrossFit, my made-up word between lunch and dinner. And so there was pilgrim's meals, and they were €10 usually, and it was three courses plus a glass of wine. So they were very good, and they were pretty much at every place that you stopped at. So quite often in the afternoon I would have this pilgrim's meal, very reasonable priced. I didn't stay in albergues, which was, I felt, mainly for younger people carrying packs on their backs, and they often had to share in a room with about 50 other people. The people that I spoke to staying in albergues were often complaining they couldn't sleep because of the snoring, and that was largely from snoring of men. I stayed at places where I had a room to myself and an ensuite, and it could be just a simple bed and breakfast. It was booked in advance through, once again, the company I mentioned, Our Walker's World. Highly recommend them. So I didn't have to worry about accommodation in advance. Some people that were just turning up and hoping to find somewhere were often caught short. I remember being at a monastery, which was where I was staying the night, and it was amazing there. And I was sitting in the garden having a cold drink with some other trekkers. And this person turned up, and he'd been walking, he said, for 40 kilometres, and he was absolutely had it. And he was from Switzerland, and he was hoping to stay there the night, but the place was full. And we all felt really sorry for him, because we were quite a way out of town, and I don't know where he could have stayed. So I wouldn't like to leave up to not knowing where you're staying and not having booked in advance. I think that would be my tip, not to really do that.
As ladies, we do like to make sure we have a room, somewhere to put our heads at the end of the day rather than sleep on the side of the road. I'm feeling for this trekker too. Mm. I wonder where he did stay. That's another reason why you perhaps would book in advance before leaving New Zealand. And there's another really practical question here from Sylvia. She asked, did you prefer boots or sandals? As there seems to be people who swear by both or one or the other. What did you wear on your feet? Because, I mean, after the blisters experience, you'd probably be the expert.
That's a very good question, and it's one that needs to be addressed, and people need to understand it before they even head off. I actually wore Skechers, which are really comfortable sports shoes, and I would highly recommend them. Like, they're spongy. You feel like you're on top of the world walking in them. I recommend not to wear boots. I saw so many people walking the Camino with flip-flops on and their boots slung over their shoulder because they'd cause their feet to end up with blisters. Particularly in the hot weather when your feet swell and the boots don't swell. Yeah. And so I definitely recommend not wearing boots. In relation to trekking sandals, I did see lots of people wearing them, and I ended up buying some along the way myself with another trekker that I'd met up with, and we still had our socks on from our shoes, and we tried on these sandals and they felt so amazing that we paid for them and walked out of the shop. We looked a sight. We had black socks on and these sandals, but they were extremely comfortable.
It sounds a very Kiwi look there, the black socks and sandals. Well, that's a really good answer. Now, oh my gosh, we've nearly out of time today. And we haven't even gone near your role on the Te Araroa Trail Board, which is another subject that I really is dear to my heart. I really would love to try that trail. What do you hope to achieve from being involved on the board of that trail?
Yes, so I've just had one board meeting so far, and I think I was appointed to the board because of my experience on the El Camino. So the El Camino is really well set up because it's been running for thousands of years. The New Zealand trail, which is the Te Araroa Trail, has only been going for 7 years, and they're not as well set up. So, yeah, there's not so many places to stay the night or to eat or people providing transport. So there's so much to be done on that trail in New Zealand, even raising the awareness of that trail. So I'm hoping that I'll be able to contribute my knowledge on that.
Well, I'm going to watch the space and see those developments, because it's something I would like to do myself. Would we, like the Spanish, do it in parts? The Spanish do the Camino, you know, take a couple of weeks holiday and do one part the following year, come back. But is that something New Zealanders should consider doing rather than taking 6 months off work?
Yes, definitely. I don't think I could do the whole trail in one go. 3,000 kilometres is a lot more than the 800 kilometres on the El Camino. So if I was doing it, I would do it in parts, and I think that would make it really doable for New Zealanders. There are a lot of overseas people doing the Te Araroa Trail, but not so many New Zealanders are aware of it. But if you took out 2 or 3 weeks of your annual leave and did a segment and then returned, say, the following year, I think that would make it really doable and something to put on your bucket list.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for those words of encouragement. I will give it a go. Now, one more question about the Camino from Jane. This is Camino Jane, who actually did do the that's not her real name, by the way. That's her. Walked to the Camino with myself and a friend, Mandy. And so we are called the Camino Chicas. And Jane's is a very good question. I heard the spiritual journey begins after you finish. Is that true?
Yes, that's interesting. Sometimes people divide up the Camino into three parts. I think they say the first part is physical, the second part is mental, and the third part is spiritual. And I would agree with that. So the last third part is, you know, you're on your way to the final destination, which is Santiago de Compostela, and you're very aware of all of the religious signs and symbols that you pass along the way. And Yes, I definitely feel that it was kind of divided up into those three parts, with the spiritual part being the latter third mm-hmm. of the Camino.
Yeah, and I did feel that near the end of your book there, where you'd got to the end and there was I did feel a different type of Lorraine there. So with that, Lorraine, I would like to say thank you so much for coming in to join us on Books and Beyond. There was so much to talk about, and half an hour is just not enough time. And I want everyone to know that your book is available to borrow from Auckland Libraries, and hopefully we get to see you again another time. Ka kite anō.
Thank you, Louisa.